This is what I've presented to you all these years as my long and noisy prayer, as my magic trick. And like all good magic tricks, it begins with a setup.
There are many kinds of museums. From the supersized Smithsonian to the childhood home of Muhammad Ali, from Bangkok to Boston, and everywhere in between. But museum goers only see part of the full picture. On this show, we open the crates, tell the stories, meet the people, and reveal the inner workings, unseen, unheard, until now. From Philbrook Museum of Art and Public Radio Tulsa, I'm your host, Jeff Martin, and this is Museum Confidential. Bruce Springsteen recently turned 70, but the Boss shows no signs of slowing down. Coming off a hugely successful run on Broadway, Springsteen has a new album, a new concert movie based on that album, and a feature film inspired by his music. But that's not all. In his hometown of Freehold, New Jersey, there's a new exhibition at the Monmouth County Historical Association. It's called, quite simply, Springsteen, His Hometown. Eileen Chapman runs the Bruce Springsteen Archives and Center for American Music at Monmouth University. We recently spoke with Eileen about the new show and all things Bruce. So I guess I'd like to start with the archives and talk about the origin of the Springsteen Archives and how that all came about, when, and how you became involved with it.
Sure. So in 2001, Chris Phillips, who was the editor of Backstreet Magazine, realized that Springsteen items and memorabilia were becoming very difficult to find. He used a lot of magazines and newspapers in his research and was seeing them then on eBay for a large amount of money. And so he thought it would be a great idea to put out a call internationally and ask folks to send some of their memorabilia and items to Chris, and he would display it in the Asbury Park Library. And so in 2001, I was managing the Stone Pony at the time and got invited to this opening at the library. And it was about 700 pieces, memorabilia in different shapes and forms, so magazines, bumper stickers, pins, that sort of thing. And it was a really cool exhibit. But as you can imagine, as Bruce toured, the contributions became quite large, and the exhibit and the space in the library, you know, couldn't handle any more donations. And so there was an organization that sprung up around this collection called the Friends of the Bruce Springsteen Collection. And they were helping to manage the collection, maintain the collection. They created a website. And at this point, probably in 2002, began to collect items in their homes because there was just no more space at the Asbury Park Library. And it continued that way for a few more years. I came to Monmouth University in 2006, and I was the associate director of the Center for the Arts, booking music and promoting the arts on campus, but lived in Asbury Park. So I thought it would be really cool to bring that collection here to Monmouth University. And I felt it belonged at Monmouth because we are obviously in Monmouth County, in the area where Bruce was born, raised, and, you know, began to write his songs and become famous. And he played at Monmouth University about 9 different times when he was doing the college circuit under Steel Mill, under the name Earth Child. There were a few different bands. And we're also, you know, just a few minutes from Asbury Park, which is, you know, kind of the center of music in Monmouth County and the Jersey Shore even.
Tell our listeners a little bit about the Stone Pony, because, of course, this is a major component of the Springsteen mythos, and you manage this place. This is kind of legendary music joint club in Asbury Park. I mean, not just Bruce, but of course, you know, Southside Johnny and John Bon Jovi and all these other people have kind of cut their teeth there. But talk a little bit about the history of that space and how you played into it.
So I moved to Asbury Park in 1974, and that was the same year that the Stone Pony opened up. Managers were Jack and Butch. And I was actually in the early 80s managing the club next door, Mrs. J's. And we interacted a lot. You know, I was always over at the Pony. Jack and Butch was up over at Mrs. J's. Asbury Park's a small town. It's a mile by a mile. And so, obviously, the Stone Pony was the hub of rock music, you know, along the Jersey Shore and along, really, you know, one of the primary places along the East Coast. And so I then went on to manage it in 2001. But prior to that, I mean, so many people went through that club and played there. So many national acts, so many acts that arose out of there to be signed by different labels. You know, of course, Bruce, you know, came along later on. He was already pretty famous by the time the Pony opened. But then there was Southside Johnny. There was John Bon Jovi. There was the Red House. There was just so many bands. In the wake of Bruce Springsteen being signed, the Stone Pony became a venue where a lot of the label A&R folks went to look for the next Bruce Springsteen. So bands were getting signed from the Pony just because of Springsteen's fame and then Southside's fame and John's fame and then others who came along after it.
Where did you first did you first see Bruce Springsteen? Where was can you remember your first was it there? Where was your first Bruce experience?
Yeah, so before I moved to Asbury Park and I was living in Toms River, I had a friend who was a guitar player and who would go up to the Upstage in Asbury Park. The Upstage was an after-hours club where Bruce played often and actually met most of his bandmates there. And I had a friend who was going up to be part of the jams that happened. And he kept telling me and some of my friends, you've got to come up and see this guy. This guitar player, this songwriter, you know, he's really special. He's really amazing. You've got to come check him out. He's not like any other guitar player you'll see. And so we all kind of hopped into a car one night and went up to the Upstage and watched Bruce play, you know, as part of this jam, but at that time with early members of the E Street Band. And it was quite an experience. I mean, you saw the focus and you saw the determination and you saw how he interacted with the crowd and he stood out among all the other performers that were playing on the Upstage stage that night. And you kind of knew that something special was going to happen here.
So the occasion for our chat is this new exhibition, which just opened a couple of weeks ago. And the show is called Springsteen, His Hometown, and it's there in Freehold, which is Bruce's hometown. Tell me about how you played a role in putting the show together. Obviously, the archives play a major part in the actual contents of the show, but you know who were the major players involved in putting it together, and how did it all come about?
So, you know, the Bruce Springsteen Archives and Center for American Music is located on the campus of Monmouth University. And I became the director of those archives in 2017 when Bruce did an evening with Bob Fantelli here at Monmouth University, announced that we would be his official repository as well. So that kind of changed the whole focus of what those archives looked like after they left the Asbury Park Library and came to Monmouth. You know, it was 700 pieces in the library. It was 1,500 pieces when it came here to Monmouth. And now we have about 37,000 items in our collection. So we often work with a specialist professor, Melissa Ziobro, who teaches the museums and archive management class. Her students interact with us on many levels. We have been doing some oral histories of performers and venue owners, and the students help to summarize them and make them available and accessible. But they also curated an exhibit in our Guggenheim Library last December. And the exhibit was so popular at that time, it was only up for a few weeks. We actually extended it. It was up through July. But Professor Ziobro thought that with the 100th centennial of Freehold Borough and Bruce's 70th birthday coming up, wouldn't it be great to take this exhibit, make it a little more comprehensive, and collaborate with the Monmouth County Historical Association in Freehold to actually create a huge exhibit. So that's where the thought process began. And then, of course, the Historical Society was on board, and we started to identify what items might be part of this exhibit. You know, Bruce Springsteen's career is huge. You know, it spans many decades. So to identify what pieces would fit within the confines of the Historical Association was difficult. But we went through, you know, specific timelines in Bruce's career, identified some specific moments in time and benchmark moments, and made sure that we had representation of that in Freehold. And Melissa worked with Bernadette Rogoff, also at the Monmouth County Historical Association, who has items that date back to the 1600s that talk about the Springsteen family in Freehold. So what began as a, you know, Springsteen exhibit in our minds became so much bigger and so much broader and so much more interesting, just because it also got to speak about Freehold. You know, of course, we hear Springsteen talk about Freehold all the time.
Yeah.
And then Bruce's ancestry in Freehold as well. So it was a real collaborative effort with a whole lot of people interacting to put this together.
So there was a video that was circulating right after the opening that went somewhat viral. I think even maybe Rolling Stone featured it on their website and some other places. And it was of the opening party for the exhibition. And of course, Bruce Springsteen shows up and performs the song Light of Day, which is a song that's never really appeared on any of his official albums, I don't believe. It was written for the director Paul Schrader for a film and ended up being performed in the film by no less than Michael J. Fox and Joan Jett, I believe. Mm-hmm. And so, but it's kind of one of those, the fans love it. He plays it a lot live. Was there any idea of what song he would play? You know, did you know he was going to play a song that night? You know, what was that moment like at the opening?
So the opening turned out to be a pretty spectacular event all in itself. There were 600 people who either purchased tickets or were invited guests, and it was in a beautiful area, a tented lawn at the back of the Monmouth County Historical Association. And Bruce was actually in New York with his family because his daughter was riding in competition that day. So we really didn't know if he was going to make it down to the opening or not. It was kind of touch and go throughout the day. And at some point during the afternoon, we realized that he was going to make it at some point, but we weren't sure if he was going to make it for the opening, before the opening, after the opening. And he finally arrived, I guess, around 7:30. And came in and spent a lot of time looking at the exhibit. I thought he would, you know, he would be rushed for time. He wanted to get back to New York with his family. So I thought he would kind of, you know, just do a breeze through and maybe come back at another time. But he actually spent about 45 minutes in there and read every caption and talked about some of the materials that were there, either with me or with Bernadette Rogoff from the Historical Association, and really was very... He was very overcome with emotion looking at this exhibit. And then we knew he had to get back to the city. So, you know, he stopped to say hello to Bobby Bandiera, who was performing, and to Joe Grushecki, who was performing that night. And then he and Joe began to talk about maybe doing a song together. You know, Joe Grushecki performs for the Light of Day Foundation often in January each year in Asbury Park. And so that's a song Joe and Bruce have played together often. Ironically, Bob Benjamin, who the Light of Day Foundation began around, was also in attendance at this event. So, you know, last minute, Bruce said, you know, I'm going to do a song. And he got up with Joe and performed Light of Day. And, of course, it was amazing. The crowd loved it. And, you know, it was a classic Springsteen night where he just shows up and plays spontaneously.
It seems like, you know, it's interesting, obviously, Bruce Springsteen just turned 70 years old, which is a milestone in anybody's life, but he's certainly having a moment, because I was thinking about, you know, we have this exhibition happening. You recently had this Blinded by the Light film come out. You have his own film, Western Stars, which is a film that Bruce co-directed, which is about to come out in wide release, of course, tied to his album of the same name. There's all these things happening right now. Do you think that's by design? Do you think that as he's kind of aging, that he's feeling any kind of urgency to produce more, to do more? Is this output in any way tied to the sense of a clock that's ticking, or is it just timing?
I think it's just Bruce being his creative self. You know, you see him reinvent himself so many times, you know, going from an album like Born to Run or Born in the USA and then Nebraska and then Tom Joad, and how this all fits together as he reinvents himself to be relevant to so many different audiences. And then, you know, I think being on the Broadway show stage for such a long period of time really took a lot of strength and energy, probably from that creative process. So, you know, Broadway's over, and here comes Bruce, and he's, you know, just cramming it all in and doing what he does best, creating new projects and new outcomes and new work for us all to be thrilled about.
Today's episode of Museum Confidential is sponsored by Permanent Collections, not as sexy or shiny as those prepackaged traveling shows, nor as newsworthy as that new immersive installation by Blah Blah Blah. Permanent Collections are the foundation on which museums are built. But it's always the same, some complain. Yeah, so does the text of Hamlet change every time it gets performed? Nope. But the possibilities are nevertheless endless. The same is true for Permanent Collections. Think you've seen it all before? You haven't. Not even close.
Do you see a lot of generational split between the audience who's maybe coming to see the show or people interested in the archives? Do you think that he's continuing to reach new audiences, younger audiences, and it's not just relegated to the boomers and maybe the Gen X audience, that, you know, the millennials have come on board and even beyond that?
Yeah, so a couple of things happened. You know, we did the Blinded by the Light premiere in Asbury Park. Actually, Sarfraz Manzoor, who wrote the story, is here at Monmouth tonight to speak about his whole process of how he grew up and how the story was written. So he's going to be here with us tonight. But what I noticed being on a college campus and being around, you know, 16, 17, 18, you know, 19, 20-year-olds, everybody was really excited with the Blinded by the Light movie. They actually wrote a piece about it in the Monmouth University Outlook newspaper, but also the Western Stars. The kids that I'm seeing here are really, you know, over the top in love with the Western Stars album. And so it, you know, I think each creative process and each output and each project that Bruce presents is really widely admired by different generations. And I even see that for people coming to the archives. I'll see parents and children who, you know, the kids are really into Springsteen now, but the parents want to show them, well, you love Springsteen now, but when I was 17, these are the shows I went to. And so you see them sharing those experiences, and that's really cool to see.
Are there pieces still coming regularly into the archives? Does it come in batches, or is it just happening all the time that the collection is growing as new materials are found or donated? How does the collection change on a day-to-day, month-to-month, week-to-week basis?
It happens sporadically sometimes. Of course, when the Broadway show ended, we got some materials from the Broadway show, and we got the original script from Blinded by the Light and some other really cool items at that point. But we have fans that donate. These donations come in from all over the world, which is important for us. You know, we want to have as much as we can in there to show Bruce's career not only here in the States, but worldwide. And we find that when visitors come in from other countries, they want to see what we have from their particular places. So those items are really important to us. But we get boxes of donations probably, I'm going to say, if not every week, every 2 weeks. And right before the exhibit was due to open, we got a donation with a signed album cover from The Wild, the Innocent, and the East Street Shuffle that we pulled out of the box and put right in the exhibit. So each donation brings to us some newfound item that we're really excited about.
How do you bring the collection? You know, at the end of the day, a collection of materials is a very passive thing. It just sits there. And so it's up to the people who run that collection and oversee it to bring it to life, to program it. So beyond this exhibition, you know, what do you guys do through the archives and through the center to activate the collection and to bring it the same energy that Bruce Springsteen brings to the stage when he's on there?
Yeah. So we have a satellite exhibit at the Grammy Museum in Newark. we just got a call from the Ryman Auditorium at the Grand Ole Opry. They're doing an exhibit and one a Springsteen exhibit within that. And we just got a call from the Woody Guthrie Museum also for artifacts for an exhibit they're doing. We just did an exhibit at the Vietnam Vets Memorial. We've got another exhibit at the Lake House Recording Academy in Asbury Park. So getting exhibits out into various places are important to us. We also host a series called An Evening With. And so Bob Santelli, of course, the first Evening With was with Bruce Springsteen. But we've done Emily Salyers from the Indigo Girls. And we just did David Sanchez and Ernest Carter and Jerry Carboy. Ernest and David, of course, left the E Street Band to form a jazz band by the name of Tone. And they had not performed together in 40 years. So on Sunday, they were all back here. Had a discussion with them about their years with the E Street Band, why they left this former jazz band and that sort of thing. So programming is important to us. We do something called Record Club, where every month, it's like a book club, but with records. We get about 200 or more people in to talk about various records, not only Springsteen records, but others as well, but just to keep people engaged. And we, you know, programming is important to us to get out there. You know, we post items on social media, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and we have a lot of people who come to visit the archive. So all the researchers and writers we have, we've helped filmmakers that write Redemption Rock and Roll, the Blinded by the Light, of course. Rolling Stone did a documentary for their 50th anniversary. All the writers that are doing Springsteen books. We have professors that are teaching college courses on Springsteen. So they visit the archives. We've done, we worked with Middletown High School where Stephen Van Zandt went to school, and they created a documentary called Sonic Highways. So interacting with students, with fans, with researchers, writers, we're active all the time. We've got 8 students who work here helping to process the donations and 2 volunteers. So it's an active space. There's people who just, you know, randomly knock on the door and want to see what we have.
I'll finish with this. I was recently listening to an interview with David Remnick, the editor of The New Yorker, and he's a huge fan of Bruce's. And he was mentioning that Bruce has been kind of an integral part of his life. Of course, David Remnick grew up in New Jersey, so there's the geographical connection. But, you know, he said, I've kind of grown up with him and used his life and his music as kind of a metric in my own life. And I wonder, you've been there in on different capacities for the same amount of time. Do you see, you know, when you look at the albums, because you mentioned earlier, there's such a diversity of style and the tones and things change so often and he reinvents himself. Do you see, as you kind of go throughout your life, that your favorite Bruce Springsteen songs, albums change as you age and you see things differently?
I do. And I often, so with the release of Western Stars, I've now gone back to listen to Tom Joad. So different things are relevant in different times of our lives, and what may be relevant now was not relevant 20 years ago. So let me pick that up and listen to it again, because now it's more meaningful for me.
Yeah. Well,
so absolutely, I see that change. I see my favorite songs change maybe by the week.
Well, there's plenty to choose from.
Well, I stood stone like at midnight, suspended in my masquerade, and I combed my hair till it was just right, and commanded the night brigade. I was open to pain and crushed by the rain, and I walked on a crooked crutch. I strode all along to a fall I'd gone.
Bruce Springsteen met Stephen Van Zandt at a club in New Jersey when Van Zandt was performing a cover of the Turtles' hit single, Happy Together. They became fast friends and collaborators. It wasn't until the 70s that Van Zandt became an official member of the E Street Band, rising to even bigger heights during the MTV/Born in the USA era. Van Zandt was that recognizable bandana-adorned guy playing guitar right next to Springsteen. About a year ago, Van Zandt was in Tulsa to perform at a benefit concert for teachers. On a lark, we tweeted him and invited him to stop by Philbrook for a tour. A short time later, he tweeted back, "I'm coming." We spent the better part of 2 hours walking the museum and gardens, allowing for deep digressions on everything from Durer and the German Renaissance to modern art and things he liked. And of course, many stories about life on the road and in the studio. Much to our delight, Van Zandt was more than happy to share, more than happy to relive those, forgive us, glory days. That's our show for this week. Museum Confidential is produced and edited by Scott Gregory at the studios of Public Radio Tulsa. To learn more about what's going on at the museum and at the station, visit philbrook.org or publicradiotulsa.org, or both. We suggest both. Until next time, look closer.